Adame. Mr. Campbell?
May it please the court. The district court's judgment of conviction in this case should be reversed, and a judgment of acquittal entered because of the insufficiency of the evidence, or in the alternative, remanded for a new trial because of the prejudicial evidentiary that took place. I'll start with the insufficiency of the evidence as to the interstate commerce element of the arson statute 844I. In a criminal prosecution, every element of an offense, even an interstate commerce element, must be proven with individualized proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
So let me ask you why that isn't the case. I mean, there is a lot of individualized proof here. Nobody's just saying because there was a fire, it affected interstate commerce. After Jones, after Russell, you know, one doesn't do that. But there's proof that there are actually three commercial units in this building, two for residents that have active leases, one that's for rent but empty. So that's individualized proof. And under Russell, when you've got to the point of proving that the building is being used in a commercial capacity, you are not anymore in the situation that Jones treated, you know, with private residences, with, say, interstate gas hookups or something. That was the line the court was drawing. So I'm not clear what else you think needs to happen.
Well, I think that what the proof here showed was that it was, in fact, as you mentioned, Your Honor, a property that was rented for various purposes, residential units up top, a vacant commercial space below. But that only goes to the question of what was the property.
Do me a favor. Pull your little microphone closer to your mouth.
Of course, Your Honor. Is that better, Your Honor?
I don't know. Talk and I'll find out.
So I think that the proof that this was, you know, used for residential apartment renting upstairs and a vacant commercial space downstairs went to the function of the property, which is the first prong that the Supreme Court set
forth
in Jones.
What testimony or other evidence do you think Russell calls for? Russell says Congress means to use its full Commerce Clause power. And so we know it can simply affect interstate commerce. And we know from, you know, I'm thinking actually in the antitrust area, think cases like Summit Health against Pinnace or so on, that, you know, even if you're one little ophthalmologist in Los Angeles, you know, you affect interstate commerce. So I can't see why there's anything but, you know, an insubstantial argument that this, that being in the business of renting property, whether for residents or for commercial activities, doesn't satisfy this.
Well, I don't think that Russell was purporting to set forth anything about the sufficiency of the evidence in that case or a question of whether or not individualized proof was required. What Russell was addressing was a statutory argument that originally originated from this court, which was a question of
a lack of jurisdiction,
an attempt to dismiss the indictment for lack of jurisdiction, that the offense was not within the scope of the statute. So it was a question of statutory interpretation, and there were the statements, as you mentioned, about congressional power to enact the statute.
Which is very broad, and we have held that any commercial building actively used for a commercial business does meet the interstate commerce element.
And there are the holdings of this court that do say that, but as I set forth in the brief, I think that those decisions should be read narrowly, or potentially narrowed under Circuit Rule 40E, because they're in conflict with other decisions of this court which interpret interstate commerce elements of other federal criminal offenses, such as United States versus Peterson, United States versus Groves, where there was an interstate commerce element. The government did try to resort to an argument, oh, you can just find this as a matter of law because the Supreme Court has said drug dealings and interstate commerce.
Well, those are different statutes. I'm going to redirect you and ask you to talk about Agent Rashke's testimony. He's been before us personally in more than one case, and he does in this instance qualify what he's saying. He's saying, you know, I can tell you about which tower this phone is able to make contact with. I can't really tell you whether he's inside the apartment or down on the street or whatever. So why isn't that something that just goes to the weight of the evidence and not its admissibility? Because I gather you're arguing that it should have been kept out altogether under Rule 702.
That's right, Your Honor, and I think that this court should review that, you know, decision de novo, because the district court merely looked at prior judicial acceptance of testimony like Agent Raschke's. But when you look at what Agent Raschke was testifying to, we're not challenging here the testimony that the cell phone connected to Tower X at a given time. That is testimony that has been accepted. That's not challenged. The question is, what does that mean? What does it mean? What can you take from the fact that the cell phone tower connected? And Agent Raschke doesn't have the qualifications. His methodology for extrapolating from that isn't reliable because he doesn't...
But does he ever actually say, though, that because when I'm standing in this apartment... my Sprint phone is connecting with whatever the number was, you know, Tower 785 or whatever.
825, yes.
Yeah. He doesn't say that last thing, and so is that enough to qualify it in a way that we can have confidence? And I guess the second question I have is when you have the evidence... that he leaves the car, that Navarette drops him off, he comes back to the car 2 hours later with the two full garbage bags, you see the stuff in the garbage bags came from Adame's residence, or they find it in the residence and see that it was the stuff from Ortiz's apartment. Why isn't this cell tower analysis cumulative, and so even if it was a mistake to admit it, harmless?
Well, I think that the way it was used was to place Mr. Adame in the apartment.
Right, and I'm saying that the garbage bag evidence also places Mr. Adame in the apartment.
I think that's certainly a permissible inference for purposes of an analysis that the jury could have undertaken, but I think that the testimony is stronger in that it has the imprimatur of an expert. It is the only testimony that sort of directly says he was there in the building. It does require... a few more inferences.
But staying with the garbage bags for a minute, you know, if Navarette drops him off, he comes back with these garbage bags, and then we have testimony that the stuff inside the garbage bags came from Ortiz's apartment. I don't see how he gets it without going, I mean, the part of the government's theory of the case anyway was that places him in the apartment. We have the motive, we have the fact that it burned, we have the accelerants, and we get him into the apartment, the garbage bags. And if that's true, then do we need to worry about Raschke here?
I think there's an additional element which is beyond presence. It's a timing element, right? The garbage bags don't convey any element of when allegedly Mr. Adame was in this apartment.
Well, the two-hour window, don't you think?
That perhaps is permissible, would be a permissible inference from the evidence, but the testimony
yes,
of it...
I think it's really more than permissible. It's almost overwhelming, I mean, given the scenarios that happened that night. I mean, the thing is, even if this testimony, I don't think the cell phone testimony went too far in it, but at any rate, the evidence was overwhelming here. I understand it was circumstantial, but lots of evidence that the jury could find.
Yes, Your Honor.
To support this.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that even then, if you took the position that you can use that evidence to place Mr. Adame in the apartment, that you still would be lacking the crucial evidence of the connection to the gasoline in this case. And I think that that's where all of the evidence that the government summoned would go towards location. But I think the Tenth Circuit's case in Yoakum is on point, which is, you know, presence isn't just enough in an arson case without something
right,
else.
But he told a girlfriend to drive to the gas station even though the car didn't need gas. Then he told her to go ahead and pay and just get $10 worth, and when she gets back, she sees the number of the pump go up, but she doesn't see gas going into the fuel tank.
And on top of that, he washes his hands in January right. by cleaning the windshield. I mean, who does that?
Well, I think there was...
Somebody wants to maybe get gas off their hands, I would think.
Well, I think there was also testimony from Miss Navarette herself that he was cleaning the windows because they had gone fogged up.
With his bare hands?
Well, I think that he probably wouldn't have wanted to get his gloves wet in that circumstance if he was washing the windshield. But I think that the key point is that those activities, the idea of just going to a gas station, asking someone to go in and put the cash in, those aren't the kinds of facts that would carry the weight of the entire inference that not only did he go to a gas station, but he took the gas, he put it unseen into an unseen container without getting any trace of it on him, without any smell of it, and that's enough to put all on just the simple fact of going to a gas station, which is something, obviously, that millions of Americans do every day, every week. I think it's too much for that one fact to bear. If there were was other incremental evidence, perhaps. But I think that's a crucial element here, and I think that the evidence...
But there's at least opportunity to get the... I mean, obviously, the government's case is built up of, you know, a little fact here, built on the next little fact, on the next little fact, all circumstantial, as Judge Williams says. But why a jury can't draw the inference from all of that, and that's what your position has to be, that it's actually impermissible for a jury to draw the inference that he, in fact, did get the gas, and he was washing the gas off his hands, and he then, when Navarette drops him off at the apartment and he collects his stuff, he takes the backpack and he dribbles gas in there. You don't probably need that much, actually, for what he did.
Well, I think that those are a lot of inferences to put just on the fact of being at a gas station. I think on its own, that's not enough. I think that's what this court would sort of regard as perhaps a suspicion or a speculative inference. But this court has held that speculative inferences, suspicions, aren't enough. I think you have cases, the Piaskowski case, the Jones case, where you also have a circumstance where you say someone was in a place where they could have done something, been involved in criminal activity, but that alone's not going to be enough. We're not going to just go on the suspicion or the possibility or the speculative inference. You know, in Piaskowski, it was the presence before a murder. In Jones, it was cooking crack cocaine, I believe. And
no, I mean, that's a perfectly sound proposition of law. Whether it applies to this set of facts is a different question.
Well, I would certainly posit that it does. And I think the other piece of prejudicial evidence that I'd like to address to this court is this purported incriminating statement that Mr. Adame makes allegedly to Officer Garcia. And
the I didn't mean to
the
hurt,
I
Jimmy,
didn't mean to hurt Jimmy statement, right? Yeah. And that's a statement that the government referred to multiple times in its closing argument, said these are the words of a man who's guilty, who has something very, very serious to hide. So it was obviously something that the government thought was important, was, you know, very helpful to its case, and I think as a result could be very prejudicial. Now, prior to
right,
that statement...
And that statement, there was no motion to suppress, right?
That's right, Your Honor. But this court has recognized that even where no motion to suppress was filed before the district court, this court may consider a suppression argument where, had a motion been presented to the district court, it would have been an abuse of discretion for the court to deny it. And I would posit that that's the case here because...
But the government argues that when he says, I don't want to talk about this anymore, that it's an ambiguous statement.
Well, I would respond that this court in Davis versus Greer specifically said the statement, I don't want to talk about it anymore, is an invocation of the right to silence. And I don't think that this statement is fundamentally different from that. And I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Nesser.
May it please the court. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, there was ample evidence that supported the jury's verdict. A properly instructed jury heard the evidence and arguments about all the defects and decided that the defendant was guilty. Your Honors ticked off some of the evidence better than I could, but the jury heard evidence about the defendant's turbulent and obsessive relationship with Ortiz.
Can I stop you there? Because I was very unhappy with this video that went back to the jury's room. It seemed to me utterly beside the point that there was no reason the government would have wanted them to hear Ortiz saying she looked like she's on fire if it wasn't trying through the back door to get the idea of fire in there. There was plenty of evidence that he was obsessed with Ortiz. And whether on a 403 basis or even just on a flat-out relevance basis, this just isn't good.
Your Honor, with regard to the Exhibit 26, the government did file a motion in limine on that, and there was no objection. There was no objection before or during trial to admission of that exhibit.
The jury had already seen it, hadn't it?
It had already seen it by the time it went back to the jury, and there were several videos that showed the defendant's obsessive, his motive and his obsessive relationship with the victim. Even if the judge's 403 analysis had been insufficient, any error was harmless, as Your Honor points out, because the jury had already viewed the video in open court. And it was pure speculation that the jury would view the video repeatedly to the exclusion of other evidence, if at all.
So your argument has to be that whatever damage was done by this video was already done without objection, and whatever marginal extra damage is done by sending it back to the jury, and again, I'm just anticipating what you're probably saying, wasn't enough to spoil the whole trial.
Your Honor, well, the video was probative of the defendant's state of mind and of his relationship with Ms. Ortiz. The video was taken...
So there's just a fundamental difference here. I mean, her question was, and you should have actually said, yes, the evidence was overwhelming, so even if there was an error, this video, letting it go back to the jury, didn't have any impact. But, you know, the fact of the matter is you had several videos that showed his obsession, so why did you even need the video that said fire in the first instance? I understand it wasn't objected to.
Correct, Your Honor, and we do agree that it was harmless in light of all the other evidence.
And
in the
so
case.
You're throwing the fire in is just inviting error. It just seems so needless when you have this other evidence and commenting she looks like she's on fire, and she's, oh, it's a fire case, maybe he was trying to burn her up too. You know, it just leads to this speculative chain that's completely unnecessary.
Well, as Your Honors have pointed out, in an arson case, it's usually reliant on circumstantial evidence, and the defendant's motive in this case was highly probative.
But you don't understand. The thing is to say that you look like you're on fire, and this video took place like not the day of or something. It was like way before, right?
It was about 2 weeks beforehand,
right.
Your Honor.
And it doesn't, and you can't really show any real connection between that video and the fire. It's just like it's like excess. It's like, why did the government even need to introduce it? You know, because the case would be cleaner. You already had all these other videos shown. I mean, that's the point.
Right. And why invite error? I mean, you know,
yeah,
it just
I
seems
mean, it's
to
just
me
like extra work. In. Why do this when that's going to be the thing that'll probably be the most controversial should you get a conviction?
Right, which is, I believe, why the government decided to file a motion in limine to tee this issue up before trial. And there was no objection. There was no 403 objection at all. It came in clean with no objection at all.
Yeah, I mean, you can't count on that. But anyway, let me ask you about Agent Raschke, because we've had a number of these cell tower cases. And the risk here, I mean, the first thing I want to say is even though he doesn't really tee up the Rule 702 Daubert objection the way he might ideally have done, it looks to me as though the trial judge does actually consider this objection during the trial. He says things like, in any event, I'm overruling your Daubert objection. And then he discusses the merits, and then at some point he says, you know, I understand your motion to strike based on Daubert, and if it has to go up, the Seventh Circuit will review it. So I think this is properly before us. So that's point one. Point two is the risk the jury is going to attribute too much specificity to these cell things. There are all kinds of factors. And we have Agent Raschke here talking about some software program. We don't know what it is. We don't know how reliable it is. We don't know anything about this software that he uses when he's wandering around trying to see which tower a phone would connect to. And he's not using Mr. Adame's phone. If Mr. Adame has some old clunky 4-year-old phone, it's probably not going to connect as well.
I have a clunky 4-year-old phone.
Probably Judge Bauer has a clunky phone.
I have a new phone, and my phone connects nicely to a lot of things.
A little more new age.
But the fact is, the particular phone is going to make a difference, too, to how well it picks up signals and which tower. And there's just so much about this that seems to me not really to meet the requirements of Daubert or 702. I prefer to think of it as 702 myself, since it codifies Daubert. But in any event, you know, software we've never heard of, you know, telling the jury, you know, I'm standing here, my phone's doing the same thing his phone did, just strikes me, again, as overreach.
Which I think is part of the reason why the fact that this argument was waived.
It's not waived, though. I'm telling you, if the district judge is saying, I'm ruling on the Daubert motion, you can bring your Daubert thing, I understand your motion to strike based on Daubert. Those are the district judge's words. That's not waiver.
But the Daubert motion was raised for the first time in the middle of the cross-examination.
But it doesn't matter. If the judge reaches it, then you had a chance to say what you needed to say, they had a chance to say. he does object after the direct and right before cross, and the judge comments, you're a little late. But then he goes on and addresses it on the merits. So that's, if he had said, you're a little late, I'm not going to think about it, then we're in abuse of discretion, manage your own trial territory, and largely we defer to the district judges on things like that. But that's not what he does. He entertains it on the merits, and he says he's overruling it on the merits.
Correct, and I think that was based on a long line of cases, including this court's most recent opinion, which found that historical cell site analysis can show with sufficient reliability that a phone was in a general area, especially a well-populated one.
Well, that's right. So general area. So if the question had been, was Mr. Adame in Rockford or was he in Chicago, this would have been great evidence because that level of specificity really can't be contested. Was he inside Ortiz's apartment or was he two blocks away at a convenience store? Not at all clear on this record that the cell tower could distinguish those two.
Well, here I believe that Agent Rashke testified in a very reliable and cautious manner.
What's his software program? Do we have any idea?
He testified that the software program shows what signal.
Does it like find my phone? I mean, you know, what is it? I mean, there's software and there's software. We don't have any idea if somebody says, oh, I have some software. You know, that doesn't tell me a thing. Have you ever looked at the App Store on your iPhone? There's like a lot of software out there that you might have.
Yeah, the software was not a subject of cross-examination here. And the software he testified was similar to what some standard phones, maybe not Judge Bowers, but some phones can show you which signal is the strongest. And he testified that he is not making a statement that a cell phone always connects to the strongest signal. He testified that this is not a GPS. He said he's not making any assumption it's connecting to the closest tower. He just said that using the software at those key addresses, the crime scene, the parking lot, the two houses at issue, that his software did connect to the same towers that the defendant's and Ms. Navarette's phone connected to, and therefore it is consistent with the fact that their phones were located in the same area he used the software. With regard to the post-arrest statement, as Your Honors know, the defendant's argument is based largely on information that is outside the record on appeal. The circumstances under which you should consider such information is limited, and the defense had an opportunity to file a motion to suppress in the district court, had the opportunity to cross-examine the testifying officer at trial about the statements, but it chose not to, and as a result, this court is operating on a very limited record without sufficient information about the statement.
So you think we can't even get to this comparison to what's said in Davis against Greer, for example? I don't want to talk about it anymore because the statement, I don't want to talk about this anymore, it's not in the record.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. It's not in the record at all, and the identical situation was presented in the Acox case and also in the Daniels case, which is cited in the defendant's brief. And under similar facts, this court held that it would not reach the merits of hypothetical motion to suppress based on hypothetical testimony and material not in the district court. In the Daniels case, this court held that the defendants knew all they needed to know. They didn't file a motion to suppress, and because good cause did not excuse the lapse, that you could not consider their argument on appeal, and Your Honor should do the same in this case.
I just have one question. I know that it was 3 hours into the interview that he said, I can't tell you why, in response to a question. I don't want to talk about this anymore. How far in was that? Just remind me.
That statement is contained outside the record. If you'd like me to answer that based on the ATF reports that are not in the record.
Okay, because I just wanted to clear. I didn't see it in the. Okay, thank you.
There are no further questions?
Mm-hmm.
Then the government asks this court to affirm the conviction of the defendant.
All right, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Campbell?
Yes, sir.
Just a few brief points. First, with respect to the testimony from Agent Raschke, while the government has talked about sort of Agent Raschke was being cautious, I just want to focus that despite the language in which his conclusions were couched, he actually purported to make very specific findings that aren't supported. So, for example, and I would point to, I think it's A144 in the record, is a place where Agent Raschke says, the cell phone testimony is consistent with Mr. Adame being in Ms. Ortiz's apartment, but it's inconsistent with him being at the parking spot that's three buildings down on the same apartment block. That's the kind of specificity that he's purporting to testify, despite the guise of, I can't tell you what specific address it's at. When you look at what he's really testifying to, it's very granular in a way that I don't think either this court's precedents or the precedents of other courts would support. With respect to the preservation of the record issue, to Judge Williams' question, the question about what time the invocation was is in the appendix. The dispute over whether or not it's in the record, I'll address in just one second, but that's at A250, I believe, is the site. It's a few hours in, is my understanding. And to the preservation of the record, I would just say that this court's standard for reviewing motions to suppress based on what would a district court have done had it been presented with a motion is only fully realized if you actually consider the full body of evidence that could have been presented to the district court in such a motion.
But you need to make proffers usually. I mean, you know, there is a way to handle that kind of thing that was not followed here. I know it's not your fault, but it was not, in fact, followed here.
That's right, Your Honor. But I think that to truly analyze what would a district court have done, you should look at a limited scope of evidence. I don't think that looking at the extra record evidence in this case would fully expand this to some kind of mini habeas proceeding or something where you're, you know, doing extra investigations. It's looking to my time is finished. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And I you are handling this case at the court's request.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we thank you very much for
your
assistance,
Your Honor,
to the court
thank
and
you,
to your client. Thank you as well to the government. We'll take the case under advisement.